If you watch MTV this week, you will see musicians ranging from Aerosmith to Elton John to Steve Winwood. You will not see Neil Young. MTV has decided not to air his video, which is based on this song, This Note's for You.
Ain't singing for Pepsi.
This Note's for You was directed by my guest, Julian Temple. He's directed innumerable rock videos, including David Bowie's Jazzin' for Blue Jean and Mick Jagger's Running Out of Luck with Dennis Hopper. Julian Temple also directs feature films. Absolute Beginners, a 1986 musical about English teenagers in the 50s, is his, as is The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, a surrealistic documentary about the making and the marketing of an infamous punk group, the Sex Pistols. This movie was actually a student project of his when he was studying at the National Film School in the late 70s.
I was very lucky in the way that a lot of young filmmakers start off by getting involved with a band and seeing whether they can do a cheap video for them or whatever. And I approached the Sex Pistols very, very early on, just when they were starting, before they were known, to do some music in a student film that I was doing. I was looking for a band and was told about them and went along to the warehouse where they were rehearsing, and I just opened the door and thought, well, I better film these guys rather than what I was doing, because they were so strangely strong and new and different at the time.
You had to rent the cameras from the film school and all that?
Well, I had to sneak them out, actually.
how do you sneak out a bulky film camera?
Well, you buy the guy who has the key to the camera room some drink, or there are various ways of doing it.
Which you're not going to reveal to us, lest you have to do it again.
That's right.
Did you have to go through the academic exercise then of screening this for your film professors?
Well, the strange thing was it was actually released as a feature film, you know, before I finished the course, and I did literally spend most of my time making this film rather than attending the school. And initially, I think they took a rather dim view of that, but in the end, they seemed impressed that it had actually, you know, been made into a movie that was all over the country and all over the world, actually.
Did you set out to do a documentary almost? Because that's sort of the feel that it has.
Well, yeah, for a long time I was purely filming, you know, whatever the group were doing, and acting as a kind of Boswell for them with a movie camera. But in the end, we decided, you know, we had all this material to try and find a framework in which to make a full-length movie out of it. And we were trying to play around a little bit with the notion of a documentary and try and create a feeling where certain things that had actually happened seemed totally impossible and untrue, and where certain things that hadn't happened, we tried to make them believable. So we were actually playing around with the reality of that group in order to make people really ask their questions about what really did this mean. You know.
Was it, by we, do you mean Malcolm McLaren, who was a driving force behind the group?
Yeah, very much so. He was very much involved in the film.
There was a court case going on, though, while this film was being edited, wasn't there, about the rights to the money, and Johnny Rotten had been fired, and all this was going on. I mean, was there an effect of that on the film at all?
Yes, it did mean that we kept running out of money and having to stop and then start again later. I mean, the whole surroundings of the Sex Pistols was incredibly litigious, and you know, even many years after the film came out, they were still arguing. They went into receivership, and you know, the money was still being argued over until a couple of years ago, actually. But the thing about the Sex Pistols was that, I mean, the reason that I was so excited to make a film about them was that they were really a cultural, social phenomenon as much as more than a musical one, and in a way their legacy was more the headlines than the record that they made. And in many ways they broke up the incredibly stagnant pop culture of the mid-70s in England, certainly, and I think I believe it was similar here in America, and although the waves from the punk thing took longer to get through, but they really created a very intense atmosphere of the idea that anything was possible. If you were a young person, you could just pick up a guitar and become a pop star, or you know, certainly as a young filmmaker, I was able to get through the kind of cracks that this cultural earthquake led by the Sex Pistols opened up, you know. And
but was this a manufactured phenomenon? I mean,
well, it was. It was there was certainly a kind of building steam of anger and I think resentment amongst kids in England, partly because of the very, very high unemployment at that time, and the idea that you went to school and learnt about empire and were told you were part of this somehow chosen race of being English and you once ruled the world and you should still think in that way, and then you leave school and you don't have a job. I think there was a very real anger building up, which punk in many ways was the outlet of. I think there was also a sense of real betrayal that the music of the 60s had become so so middle of the road and tame and useless in terms of young people. So there was a need for a real change in music. The Sex Pistols were the very pure leaders of that. They then got caught up in this media kind of maelstrom, and they did start manipulating and playing around with the effect that they could have in the British tabloid press. Mm. And I think in many ways that was their greatest thing. They showed that you can treat the media as a kind of art form, as a sculpture. The information that you disseminate can be your art piece, and in many ways I think that's what Malcolm's was, you know. Mm.
My guest is film and video director Julian Temple. You were setting out to do what you could call rock videos, although at the time you were working in film almost from the beginning then, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true that the whole idea of MTV came from the work being done in videos when they started in England in the late 70s. And I was lucky enough to be, you know, involved in the Sex Pistols thing and then to get involved in the video thing when it started, which was actually probably a much more exciting time to be making videos than it is today. Mm. Because in that time it was very much a new form, and the people working in it were mapping out, you know, really what you could do with it, and the record companies were not as hip to how to use it as they are now. It's become a lot more like conventional advertising, I think.
When you are hired to do a rock video, how many of the decisions are made beforehand by the artist or, you know, even at this point, the record company?
Well, as I say, it has changed. I think, you know, more and more the record company are very involved in terms of the kind of image they want projected for the groups, especially the younger groups that they're signing, and it varies from artist to artist. Someone like David Bowie does get very involved in the concept and the ideas that he wants around the song. The Stones, for example, just let me do what I wanted. In fact, I really didn't want to do the thing for the Rolling Stones because, as I was saying, you know, I'd worked with the Sex Pistols, and the Rolling Stones were the kind of jet set antithesis of the Pistols in the 70s, although in the 60s there had been strong similarities. Mm. So it was not the done thing to work with the Rolling Stones, and I certainly didn't want to do that. So I wrote a very strong script, which I was sure they'd turn down, and that I could get out of it kind of gracefully by just saying, well, this is what I'd like to do. And I went as far as I could, and then they turned around and said, great, yeah, we'll do it, which meant that I had to really do the stuff with the Stones.
My guest is film and video director Julian Temple, and his latest project is the new Neil Young video, which we're not going to see on MTV, right?
Yeah, it seems that's... I had a feeling they might show it in the end, but I don't think they are going to. Actually.
Well, it's strange, because they did show it as sort of part of a newscast, right, where they said, oh, by the way, we're banning this video, and here it is.
Right, I think we had some little secret moles on our side in MTV, actually, who You know, I think a lot of the younger people on MTV did want to play it. I'm thinking of putting bits of it in the new Neil Young. I'm just doing another one, so I may put bits of it in that and see how they handle that one.
You also offered to take bits out of this one. I mean, this one's for you, and they didn't bite.
Right. Well, the whole story was a little strange because we had cleared whether they'd play the song and the video up front, or I don't think the record company would actually financed it. And we sent them the script, and there seemed to be no problem. We then sent them the finished video, and they loved it and said, great, we'll give it our world premiere or whatever treatment. And then suddenly we heard that it was not going to be shown at all from a higher authority within the corporation, I guess. I think it's, you know, I think it's a sad thing because it's not as though that's the most extreme violence or something that kids shouldn't see. You know, it's a very light-hearted look at a problem that I think is quite a serious problem, that the music is losing its soul and being taken over by these corporate drink companies. And I think the song is a very powerful statement that should be heard, and it surprises me that things have got so safe on MTV that they can't play something like that.
Yeah, the video is actually a send-up of some of the commercials that we see on TV. We see the Eric Clapton doing Michelob and Whitney Houston doing Diet Coke and Michael Jackson doing Pepsi and all this stuff. And what Neil Young does is basically say, I'm not singing for anybody. And what you have done is put they look like the real commercial, but obviously they're not, because things happen right in these commercials that, you know, do not happen to the ones that we see on TV. So is it the sponsors that are getting upset about this, do you think?
Well, I think it is, yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, problems is that MTV is so much reliant on the advertising of especially Pepsi and Coke and those beer, so that you're really going for their wallet, I think, with this, and that's the thing that upsets them most.
The argument could be, though, that a lot of, I mean, we wouldn't get to see a lot of concerts unless these corporations sponsored them. I mean, they sponsored concerts as well.
Well, they never had to in the past. I mean, I think one of the problems is that the music was better in the past and more in touch with people, so they went to concerts without being having to be subsidized by a drink company. You know, I think it is a chicken and an egg thing that we are in a period, as before punk, where the music is very out of touch with real people growing up. I don't think it's really singing for a generation in the way that it has done in the past. And, you know, in a sense, video was invented to keep that music alive because it was showing signs of senility. And I think the fact that concerts have to rely on subsidy to attract people, you know, to be able to afford to put themselves on, is another indication that the music is just not as strong as it was. And I think the effect of that sponsorship and video in many ways is to weaken the power and the edge that pop music had in the past anyway.
Did you work with Neil Young on this? I mean, did he tell you he was going to do this song and asked you to perhaps work with him?
Yeah, he did. And, you know, the song was very, very clear in its statement that it was making. So all I did was really, you know, play around with some of those images and turn them against each other in a funny way. I think that those kind of ads are part of a kind of mental landscape that you are forced to live with. You know, you, unless you're a hermit in a cave somewhere, your mind is filled with that information. You can't escape it, especially if you want to watch music on MTV. You have to wade through all the Pepsi ads and so on. And even when you're watching Michael Jackson and singing his own video, you're carrying, you know, the meaning of him having just appeared in a Pepsi ad a few minutes before. So you can't avoid that. And I think it's you know, our right to be able to satirize things that we're forced to live with, whether it be politicians or commercials or whatever, you know. And in the past, you know, that's been an accepted right, and it's very odd to ban that kind of thing, I think.
How much of this Neil Young video was your idea? How much was Neil Young's idea?
Well, I went away and wrote the script, and Neil said he loved it. So he didn't really work on the video, except I would say very strongly that the song was so clear and was such a blueprint, really, for the idea that, in that sense, he's very much the co-author of it. Although, you know, I went and made the video and he'd made the song. But I do feel we worked very together because the song was so direct and strong.
My guest is film and video director Julian Temple. His films include Absolute Beginners, The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film and video director Julian Temple. I'm reminded in our discussion about the commercialization of rock and roll and videos and so forth of a line or two from the film that you did, Absolute Beginners. Specifically, the character Colin says, where there's loot, trouble follows.
Yeah. Well, you know, Absolute Beginners was an attempt to look at the whole history of music in England, specifically, and that process of corruption. Although the film was set in 1958, right at the beginning of that real process, it was meant to be a metaphor for the whole. The summer of 58 was in a way a metaphor for the whole 25 years or whatever it was from then until the mid 80s when we made the film, and. You know, I used the parallel of punk and the 60s and was trying to bounce around ideas from any real part of that time and plant them in the beginning summer of it all. And Bowie actually played the corrupting, you know, the devil, Mistopheles advertising figure, you know, tempting this guy to lose his spirit, you know.
And yet when he does that magical musical number, Motivation.
That's Motivation, yeah.
Motivation, that's Motivation. He reminds me of Frank Sinatra doing a kind of, you know, musical number with the hat and the dancing and the, you know, globe and all that stuff that was going on.
Yeah, well, we were consciously trying to do that. And, you know, I think that's... He had to be kind of seductive, and the images had to be very compelling, because that is, in a way, what, you know, the commercialization is very seductive, you know.
Yeah, well, Sinatra's been called the first teenager as well, right?
Yeah. We were trying a lot of references, you know, cross-references in that film that I think was made it an interesting film. I think it was very ambitious, probably didn't succeed in every respect, but we culturally, I think it was a very dense and rich thing going on in there, which I don't know whether many people in America really got to see it, but it does say a lot about English popular culture.
Well, a lot of it, most of it, was based on a novel which appeared in 1959, Colin McInnes's Absolute Beginners, which then went out of print and then came back in like 1979. And it really told us a lot about what the teenage segment of the population in England was going through at that particular time. And I don't think many of us have even read that, so it informed your movie.
Yeah, because I think in a real sense, we were making a film at the end of that era. He was writing a book about the emergence of teenagers in the 50s in London, which probably was a bit later than in the States. But I think in a real sense, with the numerical decline in teenagers and their loss of power as an economic unit, and the way in which the culture has kind of run its course and is regurgitating its own past... I think that period is really at an end, where the teenager was a dominant focus of culture. I don't think it is so much anymore. And the film was trying to bookend that period, starting in 58 and ending in the mid-80s.
There was a lot of conflict going on in England at that time. There was a conflict between the cultural groups, the mods, and what became known as the Teddy Boys. And there was the black and white conflict, which essentially culminates in what became the Notting Hill riots of 1959.
You have to realize that, you know, really in England before the war, there were no black people at all, unlike America, where they've been here for hundreds of years. And the immigration that occurred in the 50s was a very new thing, and a large number of black people arrived in a very short time and had a very startling effect on what was essentially still a very Victorian, uptight city, with very little interracial cosmopolitan aspects to it. And they really changed the whole attitude in London in a short period of time. And I think when people look at swinging London, the explosion of music and fashion and so on in London in the 60s, part of that comes from the arrival of West Indians and Africans in the decade before. And in a way, my film Absolute Beginners was a celebration of that, and a celebration in many ways of the attitudes of the 60s and of punk, which are, you know, anathema to Mrs. Thatcher and what she's trying to do in England to get back to that earlier, more boring Victorian version of life in London, which she's, you know, trying to do there.
I have to ask, though, why you made the decision to portray these riots. I mean, it builds up to a point where there's you know, real conflict and tension going on there, to make it, then turn it into a dance number.
Well, at the time, there were riots going on in London, Brixton, for real, actually. It was, again, another strange similarity between the 50s and when we were filming. And they weren't really race riots. The thing that really you find in those London riots is that often it's an expression of anger, of kids who haven't got a job, have nothing to do, have no feeling of any future, have no money to go to the movies or whatever, and to have a fight in the street or set fire to a car is a spectacle and an entertainment. Whether you know that's maybe a strange way of looking at it, but I think for those kids that's very much what it is, and to me that's a real indictment of the fact that they are so bored that they have to do that, and they feel they have nothing else to do. So I was trying to make the point that although newspapers and politicians can try and dress it up in racial overtones a lot of the time, many of these riots, and in 58 when it was Teddy Boys, out of work, dead-end kids who started going for the blacks in Notting Hill, they were expressing their frustration and how messed up they were, rather than really deep-seated racism, I don't think.
I just want to tell you how much I saw Absolute Beginners when it first came out in London, and I watched it again over the weekend, and it's growing on me. and when you were talking about the Kinks, I got this, you know, quiet little quell in my spirit, because that Doll's House version of Quiet Life, I think, is one of the most wonderful moments in that movie. I could watch it again and again and again.
Oh, that's great. I think it is a kind of film that you can watch more than once, which in a way comes out of doing videos where you are making something that is going to be repeated again and again. People are going to see it again and again, and I think that the whole attitude behind that is going to more and more influence movies, because a whole generation of kids have grown up watching videos again and again and renting movies on video and rewinding them and watching them again, so they're tuned into picking up things in the frame, the color, the movement, the props, the objects. They have a very incredibly sophisticated visual sense that I think wasn't as developed in audiences before. And I think you are going to see a lot of movies of that kind that you do want to see again, and that are packed with visual argument and humor and irony. You know, I think Beetlejuice, in a way, is like that, and Roger Rabbit. They're very densely visual films that in a way demand to be seen more than once.
Can I ask you briefly to describe your new film, Earth Girls Are Easy?
Well, that's a look at Los Angeles, really, specifically the Valley, from the eyes of three truck drivers from outer space who land in a swimming pool in the Valley and you know, can't really believe that any form of life can really exist in this way. And it's this comedy of manners. They land in the pool of this manicurist who, and they are wonderful seal-like men. They're men, but they have this very short seal-like fur. And one of them's bright red, one of them's bright blue, one of them's bright yellow. So they're like the three strip Technicolor men from outer space who come into this girl's life. And she takes them to the beauty parlor and gets rid of their fur. And they underneath are these gorgeous guys, but everyone thinks they're from Finland or some strange place. But in fact, they're really from outer space, seeing the valley in a very fresh perspective, hopefully.
Is this anything like perhaps an Englishman's first visit to the valley in California?
Yeah, that's really why I did it, because, you know, if you come from London, you might as well be flying in from Mars when you get to Tarzana or, you know, Northridge or wherever it is in the valley. It's a very, very, very different organization of life there. So I was, yeah, consciously trying to make a film about the impact of just seeing that for the first time, really.
Well, we wish you a lot of luck with it.
Okay.
Julian Temple, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Okay, great to talk to you. Thanks.
My guest has been video and film director Julian Temple. He directed the not-to-be-seen on MTV video of Neil Young's song, This Note's for You, and the 1986 musical movie Absolute Beginners. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.